welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the efforts underway by Trump and his loyal governors like DeSantis in Florida, Kemp in Georgia, and Ducey in Arizona to engage in deliberate efforts to undercount their state's COVID-19 deaths. An expert in what influences the morbidity and mortality experience in the adult population, Mark Haywood, a professor of sociology and research associate at the Population Research Center at the University of Texas, joins us to discuss the firing of Florida's top COVID-19 data scientist, whose dashboard has been universally praised by researchers and the White House's Dr. Birx. Then we have the flagrant example of Georgia Governor Kemp's Department of Health releasing a doctored graph showing a decline in deaths by resorting the dates to create the illusion of a lower death count. And in Arizona, Governor Ducey won't name nursing homes where seniors are dying because it is bad for business. With public health professionals warning the country's deaths from the coronavirus are already undercounted and the real numbers are at least 25% higher, it remains to be seen whether Trump will succeed in continuing the undercounting throughout the election as the bodies pile up. Meanwhile, the reality TV stuntman's daily distractions continue to divert the press's attention away from his bungling, whether it is his dubious claim he's taking an unproven malaria drug or his response to the fact that the U.S. has a third of the world's COVID cases and over a quarter of the deaths, when he actually said that the appalling statistics are, quote, a badge of honor. We are left to ponder whether belief, no matter how bizarre, now trumps facts in our divided country. Then we'll explore another of the daily dose of demonizing democratic norms from a president entirely focused on his re-election, which increasingly will have to rely on voter suppression and Russian help. With Trump attacking voting by mail with false claims and absurd charges against Nevada and Michigan, a state facing disastrous flooding for which a normal president would be offering aid and comfort, we will speak with an expert on election law, Justin Levitt, Associate Dean for Research and a Professor of Law at Loyola University School of Law in Los Angeles. He joins us to fact-check Trump's false charges and unconstitutional demands. Then finally, we'll speak with Karen Greenberg, Director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, about her article at Tom Dispatch, COVID-19 is Destroying the Myth of American Exceptionalism. She joins us to discuss the dangerous path we are on as Trump escalates his campaign attacks on China, which could lead to a military clash in the South China Sea, while at the same time, his crass perversion of diplomacy has allowed China to win on the world stage at the WHO assembly, where threats and bullying from the US allowed China to escape responsibility for starting the pandemic. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Mark Haywood, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life courses, exposures, and events influence the morbidity and mortality experience of the adult population. He has served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology. And currently he's a member of the Committee on Population, National Academy of Sciences, and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Haywood.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Mark, in both the state of Georgia and in particular the state of Florida, where earlier there were reports, particularly I talked to the reporter who broke the story for the Tampa Bay Times about how the local officials sending in the death counts from COVID-19 were finding that their information was not being was being sort of blocked by the state or bottled up, I guess would be a better way to put it. And now, of course, we had the firing of the top person in Florida, the scientist who was doing what's called the dashboard, which was monitoring Florida's rising number of COVID-19 cases, Rebecca Jones. She was the manager of the Geographic Information System team at Florida's Department of Health. So is there something going on here that could be orchestrated and coordinated in terms of some of the governors who are very friendly to Donald Trump undercounting the deaths of COVID?
Well, I would say, Ian, that certainly the optics of all of these cases are not good. Everyone should be striving for transparency. And I know I would caution us to not run immediately to more conspiracy theory, although in these days you probably wouldn't want to throw anything out. But, you know, some states are quite fully fleshed in terms of their vital statistics reporting. And the systems within which they operate, such as California's a fully fleshed system, when deaths occurred and the evaluation of the causes of death that happened, it's a pretty rapid process. But when you're in different states that have more rural populations, we have difficulties in wrapping up the actual death counts, and never mind the actual information about the causes of death. You know, a lot of what we hear now about, you know, people going back and they're worried about going back and identifying COVID as a cause of death, this is actually a normal process where we're always trying to look at the quality of the data and make sure that we're accurate in terms of assigning causes of death. Going back and querying and evaluating, if we have bad reporting and bad information on the death certificates, as an example, is just a normal part of the process.
Well, specifically, Rebecca Jones, who, by the way, has been praised by Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, who most people consider to be very credible, and the president himself seems to have a good relationship with her. She praised the dashboard that Rebecca Jones was in charge of. And Rebecca Jones has said that her dismissal came after she refused to manually change data to drum up support for Governor DeSantis's plan to reopen the state. So there's certainly, if there's no fire, there's an awful lot of smoke there, Mark.
I would say there's a lot of smoke. I think there's a lot of political pressure on governors, on Republican governors in particular, because they want to open the states. You know, it's hard to tell where the interventions are coming from and within their administrations and who's doing this kind of activity, but it certainly is worrisome. So, you know, it's not just Rebecca in Florida. And by the way, if you ever have a chance, you should visit her dashboard because it's quite an incredible accomplishment. But, you know, the rearranging of the data in Georgia to make Georgia look like it's ready to open, those are kinds of mistakes that never should happen in this kind of pandemic situation. And the other part with Rebecca and the dashboard is that, you know, science and communities and individuals all depend on these dashboards to be accurate because they're making assessments of individual risks and community risks and the deployment of resources. So, you know, to not have transparency and to not have accurate data is really a travesty.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Haywood, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experience of the adult population. He served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology, and currently is a member of the Committee on Population, National Academy of Sciences, and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. So for the benefit of the audience, Mark, would you briefly describe what happened in Georgia with Georgia's Department of Public Health putting up this sort of bogus graph that showed the death count going down by manipulating the dates?
Yeah, I mean, what they did was they simply rearranged the data in a kind of descending order rather than report the data actually as it occurred on specific dates. So if they had reported the data as it looked like on specific dates, there would have been no graph, this kind of nice descending graph that they had arranged. And it was simply a matter of how they literally reordered the data to make a nice curve saying, okay, it's easy for us to reopen now.
Well, there were reports, though, when they did reopen, when they started reopening, that COVID cases shot up 40%. So what are we to believe here?
I mean, I think that when you're in a situation like Georgia, which has had a high density of hot spots, and particularly in the African-American communities, and you decide that you're going to rearrange the cases, and it's to make you look good, it's really a disservice to places in communities in your home state where they're struggling and having the hot spots increase. So, you know, not all states are even in terms of what's going on. And clearly, if you're having a lot of cases coming in, then communities have to know about what's going on. And in particular, it would be great to have a community level information reported by county. So that's the kind of stuff that Florida does. And even Texas does that.
Well, how do we get a handle on the real numbers of deaths? And the president, of course, made that extraordinary remark yesterday that it was a badge of honor that we had so many people dying. He attributed it to the fact that we do the best testing in the world, which I don't think anybody agrees with that. So that was a pretty extraordinary piece of mental gymnastics, frankly. But a couple of weeks ago, the Yale School of Public Health put out a report on the undercount, and they thought the undercount in this country back then could have been as high as 25%. What have you heard in that regard? Could you put a number on it?
I'd say that the Yale number is pretty accurate. Probably, you know, it depends on where in the pandemic you are and who is doing the testing. So at the early part of the pandemic, the number of uncounted COVID deaths was probably higher than 25%, and as we move into more testing, then the numbers are more accurate, and especially if we're in a situation where the deaths are being recorded in hospitals as opposed to at-home deaths, which are always difficult, as the nursing home deaths have shown us. It's very difficult to get a handle on them and identify them as COVID. The other part is, what's a test? So I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but some states have been including in their tallies of tests, they've been including whether someone has been tested for the antibodies, which is not the same as testing whether someone has COVID. So, and they've been including both sets of tallies in their overall COVID tests. And that gives a wrong idea about the level of testing in a place, in a state. And Texas is one of those places that it's has kind of push those numbers together in a way that makes it very difficult to know the true extent, how extensive testing really is.
So with over 90,000 deaths, what do you think the real number could be?
In terms of COVID-specific deaths, in terms of the actual causes of death, I would say, you know, a good 25% more is not, and certainly not an overestimate by any stretch of the imagination.
So it's close to 120,000 then?
I would say pretty much without a doubt.
So you mentioned, Mark Haywood, you mentioned nursing homes, which have been particularly hard hit. An extraordinary statement came out from, I think it was the health department or even the, perhaps the governor in Arizona, in response to the number of deaths in nursing homes. And they basically, the official, state official said that we don't want to count the deaths in nursing homes anymore, because it's bad for business.
Exactly.
My God, I would have thought people dying in droves would be bad for business.
It should be bad for business. I know that nursing homes struggle. They have a high risk population, but without knowing exactly where people are dying, the ability to bring resources to bear to have the state help nursing homes or have community help nursing homes, It's a impossible situation without having data and being transparent of the situation. Having had a father who lived in a nursing home in Arizona, I definitely would have wanted to have the information about what was going on within that nursing home. At least I could make some family choices as well.
So what do you think is going to happen going forward if the numbers continue to climb and if this becomes more and more of an election issue, which I think is probably, unfortunately, it's destined to be? On the one hand, you have the president saying this extraordinary thing that in the United States having the highest number of deaths in the world, more than 25% of the deaths, and a third of all the cases is a kind of badge of honor. I don't know how much longer he could sustain that kind of logic. But if Governors DeSantis and Kemp and Ducey in Arizona are sort of trying to undercount because they want to get the economy going, and they certainly seem to be on the same page with the president on that, is this going to become a real battle between truth and lies? I mean, we are in an environment where the truth is a moving target, unfortunately. And we also have a divided country where at least 40% of the people believe anything that the president says and 60% presumably don't. So given those caveats, where do you think we're going?
I think we're going into a dark pathway. It's a path that I never thought I would see us go down, which is this kind of growing chasm between what authoritarian leaders say that they believe and science. It puts science, you know, they're suggesting that scientists make things up, that they're cooking their data, that they're doing all sorts of things to kind of undercut the well-being of individuals. And that's exactly the opposite of what science is doing. And it's trying to be transparent and bringing data to bear on problems and help people actually solve problems. Science doesn't come in with the agenda, you know, a political agenda. Comes in saying, well, let's evaluate this question and figure out what's right or wrong. You know, honestly, I don't really care whether people believe in science. Science is evidence. So, you know, someone's belief to me is sadly, politically important. You know, from the science perspective, science doesn't care about that. It cares about evidence.
So could you give us a sense of whether more of the population in this country is prone to belief over facts? Where do we stand, do you think, in terms of, you know, a critical mass, if you will, of as we approach the elections?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you specifically what is going on in terms of the politics and the kinds of ways in which people are thinking, but I will tell you that the level of scientific literacy is not really healthy in the United States at the moment. So from a literacy standpoint, and I would say that's true on average, and it's even occasionally true in the press, for example. So, you know, I will give you an example from yesterday or the day before, when there was a press release that was put out by a company that said, oh, look, we've made some really good progress on a vaccine. Well, the point was that the research had not been tested by any stretch of the imagination, and it was kind of like science through press release. And that's a difficult thing, and the public doesn't know, is not as well educated in understanding what to believe. But here's a case of science with a press release where the stockholders surely are going to benefit since the stock of that company went up. But who knows in the longer run when we get into clinical trials, as we move forward with that kind of approach, that therapeutic approach, whether it will actually work or not. But gets the public's hopes up without actually educating them about the process through which we go through and establish the safety and viability and efficacy of vaccines.
Well, that press release you referred to is Moderna, and Slowey, who stood beside the president in the Rose Garden, and making this announcement that they had this vaccine that could be ready by the end of the year. And it turns out that only 8 people have been tested on that vaccine. So
correct.
That he was sort of engaging in the same kind of magical thinking the president engages in. But just in the last minute, do you think, though, that at the end of the day, as the body count goes up, that at least, I mean, if we are in an environment where belief trumps fact, the weight of facts, do you think that might eventually kind of chip away at the insularity of this belief system?
Certainly, and one would hope so. I think that
it's a terrible prospect, isn't it, when you think about it? It's a terrible prospect.
And yeah. When you think that, so I oftentimes remind people that the way that the pandemic has played out spatially is uneven, and it has started at the coasts, right? So now, though, we have a lot of hot spots going on in rural areas, and I would say in Texas we have the same thing. Our panhandle, for example, is that it has a major set of hotspots where COVID is just ravaging the rural areas. You know, as COVID moves into these areas where people have these kinds of belief systems that are not as scientifically informed, I think that they will be challenged and with the kinds of personal experiences, and one would hope that that would shift people's thinking more towards understanding the kind of facts as opposed to what people want them to believe.
Well, Mark Haywood, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Haywood, who's a professor of sociology and liberal arts and a faculty research associate of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin, whose research addresses how life course exposures and events influence the morbidity and mortality experience of the adult population. He has served on the boards of the Population Association of America and the Society of Biodemography and Social Biology, and currently he's a member of the Committee on Population, National Academy of Sciences, and the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining Trump's attacks on voting by mail with false claims and absurd charges against Nevada and Michigan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Justin Levitt, who's Associate Dean for Research and a Professor of Law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Levitt.
Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And today, Wednesday, President Trump tweeted out attacks. He seems to be escalating his attacks against mail-in voting, saying it's an invitation to voter fraud. He's also threatening to withhold federal funds from the states of Michigan and Nevada. It does seem extraordinary. Maybe this is the new normal, Justin, that we just have to get used to this insanity. But a normal president would not be attacking the state of Michigan, which he's visiting tomorrow, by the way, to visit a Ford plant. He wouldn't be attacking the state and the governor at a time of crisis when dams are broken and there's massive floods in Michigan. A normal president would be offering help and might even show up there for a photo op. Pretty strange, isn't it, that he's going on about mail-in ballots instead of addressing a real crisis in a state?
Well, it's strange, it's factually inaccurate, and it's unconstitutional. And all of that would be remarkable. Any one of that should be remarkable. But in addition, the tweets that the president gave this morning were factually inaccurate and threatened actions that, if he followed through, would be unconstitutional. And all of that should be alarming. Any one of that should be alarming. But this is the president that we've come to know and expect.
Well, let's start with the factual inaccuracies in his tweets. He tweeted out, Michigan sends absentee ballots to 7.7 million people ahead of primaries and the general election. This was done illegally and without authorization by a rogue Secretary of State. I will ask to hold up funding to Michigan if they want to go down this voter fraud path. So, first of all, they weren't sending out absentee ballots. They were sending out applications, weren't they?
Correct. And sending out applications is exactly what the Republican governors and secretaries of state in several other states have done. and exactly what prominent Republican commentators are calling for. The dispute, to the extent there is one, is primarily around, in other states and other areas, the dispute is primarily around whether to send absentee ballots themselves to a whole lot of people on the rolls. In a pandemic time, that's actually a fairly good election practice to make sure that more people take advantage of the opportunity to vote absentee when in-person voting is simply not going to be up to the task. But Michigan was a step more cautious than that. They sent, as you say, absentee ballot applications. And all that does is it makes the process of asking for an absentee ballot one step easier. It still requires people to send in the application. There are checks to make sure there's no fraud in the application process. Then the absentee ballots go out. Then the absentee ballots come back and they're checked again to make sure that there's no fraud in the process. This is about as safe as can be. And that's exactly why the Republican election officials in a bunch of other states have done the same. That is, Michigan did exactly what most Republican officials have been calling for as the safer version of making sure that the absentee system runs as smoothly as possible.
And in Trump's tweet attack today against Nevada, he said that the state had created a great voter fraud scenario. If they do, I think I can hold up funds to the state. Now, as it happens, the Secretary of State in Nevada is a Republican. In fact, she's being sued by the Democrats. So this is getting really Alice in Wonderland, isn't it?
It is very strange. First of all, the president himself has voted absentee several times, showing that he appreciates that the system can be and normally is conducted very safely and without fear of fraud. It is true that there is more opportunity for misbehavior in the absentee system than in going in person. That is a fact. It's not large in either system, and there are a number of checks to make sure that there's no fraud in the absentee system most of the time. Those checks get even more robust when we're talking about voting for statewide offices or multi-state offices like the president. It's extremely hard to steal an election by any means, but including absentee ballots when you're talking about voting for president. And even if that were true in normal circumstances, even if we're talking about policy options in normal circumstances, in the time of a pandemic, it is abundantly clear that we should be encouraging people to vote using the safe and effective and secure absentee system as much as possible, which is part of why the Republican Secretary of State of Nevada is complying with state law in doing exactly what was promised. That's all operating exactly as it should be. Over and above the president's protest at something about over which he has absolutely no control or authority and no reason to complain, then there's the threat to withhold funding from both Michigan and Nevada. And that's the unconstitutional part.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Levitt, who is an associate dean for research and a professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the U.S. Supreme Court. So what's the difference between absentee voting and mail-in voting?
There really isn't much of a difference. Some states have what's called in-person absentee voting. That's what most of us know as an early vote, where you can go in person before election day to cast a ballot. But for lay people and for most voters, absentee voting and mail-in voting refer to essentially the same thing. You sometimes apply for and sometimes receive an absentee ballot in the mail, you fill it out, and then you return it. And that sort of ability to vote at distance is what, in the time of a global pandemic, we are all going to be relying more on this fall. The circumstances in Wisconsin showed us that there can be real problems when we attempt to run an election using polling places that we're used to in the time of a pandemic. Now, I want to be really clear about this. There are some communities and some voters that need the opportunity to vote in person. So running an election truly entirely by mail for most of the country is not an option. But the way that we've come to expect ample in-person options everywhere around the country is going to be seriously impacted by the need to vote safely, by the need to keep poll workers safe and election workers safe and voters safe. And that means that we all owe it to ourselves to increase voting by mail as much as we reliably can before November.
Well, we seem to be the only country in the world that has a patchwork of different state regulations about registering to vote. Normally in democracies, as far as I can tell, and I've lived in a few of them, in Australia and in Europe, you know, you when you're 18, you are registered for life. You don't have to keep registering every time you vote. In fact, today in Wisconsin, the Bipartisan Election Commission is meeting to decide whether to mail ballot application forms to all registered voters and more than 200,000 people who are eligible to vote but are not registered. So the idea that you have to keep registering in order to vote seems an encumbrance and an unnecessary one. But what about what they're doing in Michigan? That sounds like a reasonable thing to get more people to vote. But it seems that the Republicans don't like the idea of making it easier to vote. They want to make it harder.
So there's a few things packed in there. It is true that in many other countries, the government takes a much stronger hand in making sure that people are registered to vote and able to vote. I'm actually not a huge fan of the federal government doing that work in a country the size of the United States. I actually don't mind that there are different election administrations in each state. I think that if we asked for a national system, we wouldn't get the best one. We'd get something that was a rough compromise, sort of a third of the way up the scale. And the states that do really well at this might not be happy with that outcome. It would also be susceptible to manipulation by federal administrations that people don't always trust. In the current moment, I suspect there are a lot of people who are happy that President Trump doesn't actually control the election apparatus for the whole country. There's very little of it that's within his control. Most of the elections are controlled by state officials, and the vast majority of them are very responsible about the way they exercise that authority. I would wish that governments did more, that state governments and local governments did more to keep people on the rolls reliably. In the other countries you've mentioned, part of what makes it possible to have a really robust centralized registration system is universal registries and often universal healthcare. And individuals see a lot of state services tied to their presence on that registry, not just voting, but a lot of other things. We haven't had comfort in this country with as much centralization of power in the state, either the state government or federal government. And when you say universal registry, a lot of people in this country get very antsy. That shouldn't, though, stop the state governments from bringing voter registration into the 21st century. And frankly, a lot of them, both Republican and Democrat, are doing that. They are making sure that there are opportunities to register and stay registered online. And when you interact with the government in other ways, including at the motor vehicle agencies, they are trying to put people on the rolls automatically and allow people to take themselves off, changing an opt-in default to an opt-out default. And you find that in a bunch of blue states and in a few red states. The states that are problematic are the purple states. And that's where the real problem is, incumbent legislators using the process of election administration for their own advantage. That's really the trouble that we have, the overwhelming trouble that we have, and why you hear so much about fights in swing states. But to come back to your last point, the fight we have in Michigan, a very swing state, really isn't a fight beyond the president's desire to pick one. What Michigan has done, what the Secretary of State in Michigan has done in mailing absentee ballot applications out to the public is the safest and most secure way to get people to vote. It is nothing more than an invitation. And that is as secure as it can possibly be. And as mentioned, a number of other very Republican states have done exactly what Michigan's Secretary of State has done. You haven't heard the president critique them. And that shows that he's inventing an issue really for partisan purposes that has nothing to do with the very responsible steps the Michigan Secretary of State took.
Well, I imagine that the Democrats are trying to close the gap between people who are eligible to vote and those that are registered. And that would seem to me, if you send out applications, not just to the people who are registered, but to people who are eligible, and that they could therefore register and then vote, that seems to be a very open and democratic means to exercise the full franchise. As I say, it does seem that there is a difference between the way that Democrats want to get people to vote and the Republicans don't necessarily want those people to vote if they think they're going to vote Democrat. And President Trump seems to think if you make it easy to vote, that leads to voter fraud. At least that's what he's saying. How do you overcome that divide between... Go ahead.
You can overcome that divide through some of the administrators. And I really do want to emphasize that where you've seen most of the controversy, it's yes, from the president or from extremely polarized partisan legislatures. But the administrators in each state have generally, not uniformly, but generally been doing a much better job. There's one thing I want to highlight in particular called the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. It's a consortium of dozens of states, red states and blue states. It's designed to make sure that the registration rolls are both clean and accurate. And that means taking people off of the rolls who shouldn't be or who are duplicated in a responsible way, in a surgical way, rather than a ham-handed way. But it also includes something you've just mentioned, which is reaching out to people who are eligible but not registered. That's hard to do, actually, because we don't have a universal list of people who are eligible but not registered. The way that you get that sort of list together is by combing through commercial databases and using larger vendors that offer invitations to people for other purposes and reaching out to them slowly and carefully in order to invite those who aren't registered to get registered. The ERIC system, and again, it's a bipartisan consortium of an awful lot of states, including some that some of your listeners may be surprised by, not only creates opportunities to clean the rolls productively and sensibly, it obligates states to reach out specifically to individuals who are unregistered but likely eligible and affirmatively invite them to get registered. And that's a really nice step. Other states are going about it in similar ways beyond the ERIC system by making voter registration automatic when you interact with the government in another way and show that you're eligible. So if you go in for a driver's license and the documentation you produce in order to get your driver's license shows that you're eligible to vote, some of these states are automatically putting people on the rolls, asking them, but assuming that the answer is yes. The same is true with, in some states, with applications for welfare or other benefits, where you usually have to be a citizen in order to receive the benefits. And then the government can ask at the same time whether you're interested in getting registered to vote. And usually presuming the answer, making it an opt-out as a default, helps keep the rolls full and clean and accurate. And that really is something that administrators want on both sides of the aisle.
Well, just in closing, it does seem that this is very partisan from the president, who doesn't complain about mail voting in states where he's popular, such as Florida and Arizona, and nor does he go after states that conduct their elections entirely by mail, which are Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. So this doesn't augur well for November, does it? That this is obviously Trump's on some kind of jihad against mail-in voting.
His jihad of the week changes. The target of his wrath changes based on what he thinks will help him personally. And yeah, I'm not going to defend the president's conduct. As I mentioned, his tweets this morning contain a really toxic brew of potential unconstitutional actions and flat out factual lies. And that, unfortunately, is likely to continue until November. At least his past conduct shows there's no reason to expect that will change. The plus side is that he doesn't actually run the system. The federal elections, he has very limited influence into and next to no control over, beyond using his mouthpiece. And the one superpower that we all have is the power to either pay attention to or ignore him. And so I think that your listeners can rest assured that his bark is actually in this zone. He has a lot of authority in a lot of different zones and has used it in ways that I've been very critical of. But in this zone, his bark is actually much, much worse than his bite, and we can all learn to ignore his bark.
Well, Justin, just in closing, I wish I could ignore the president, but I can't. You know, it's part of the job, I guess. But I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for the invitation.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Levitt, who's an associate dean for research and a professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the U.S. Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the COVID-19 pandemic is destroying the myth of American exceptionalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Karen Greenberg, who's director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, a noted expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. She's the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, and Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And she has an article, Tom Dispatch, COVID-19 is Destroying the Myth of American Exceptionalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Karen Greenberg.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your piece at Tom Dispatch starts out quoting the World War One song by George Cohan over there. And it seems like you would have thought that we would have learned the lesson at the end of the Cold War, which was probably the last war about nation states versus nation states, or blocks of nation states versus blocks of nation states defending their borders. Because after the Cold War, suddenly subnational and transnational threats emerged and the borders became less important. But surely now with COVID-19, there aren't any borders anymore.
Right. I mean, I think you really hit on something that I meant to suggest in the piece, which is that we are living in a world where it's a fantasy land to think of ourselves as a nation apart. And that applies to all types of things, both natural and unnatural threats, as well as to the way we go about living our lives. And it's a mindset change that apparently we haven't mastered.
So how does this, your argument in your article, relate to the notion of soft power? I know some people are not comfortable with that term, but if you watch what's been happening before the World Health Organization with its 73rd annual meeting, albeit a virtual one, where China's president addressed and he promised $2 billion, even though obviously China's got a lot to explain. Meanwhile, our president's cutting off funds, blaming them for the deaths and not himself. And in general, it's been a totally, it's backfired diplomatically. The United States has a good case, but it's squandered that case and has been unable to organize the world to force China to be more transparent about how this pandemic began. And of course, the overriding embarrassment is that we have a quarter of the world's deaths and one third of all the coronavirus cases in the world.
Right. So, I mean, there's many answers, but the simple answer is that soft power, diplomacy are incredibly important to making sure the fabric of the world doesn't collapse under the kind of strain that COVID has put it under. And, you know, blame and accountability are one side of the coin. But right now, the United States and the rest of the world confront the issue most directly of how we're going to deal with bringing to an end COVID now and preventing further outbreaks, either of the COVID style or of mutations of COVID. So in a way, it's a wake-up call that you can't operate singularly in this. All of the world is involved, all of it's related. Sharing information is important. Helping one another is important. Sharing resources is important. And all of that speaks to the soft power issue. And, you know, banging on your chest and saying, well, A, we're in the right and you're in the wrong. And B, we're going to be combative about this as possible because that's what deserved is counterproductive if what you mean by productivity is saving lives, and not just saving lives, saving the economy, the economic crisis that's come after that, and really keeping the world in a place of refinding stability, because global instability is will bring so much pain and damage worldwide. So yes, soft power, which doesn't mean there aren't issues of accountability that have to be dealt with, either in establishing new kinds of covenants, new kinds of mechanisms for those who violate any codes and laws. But right now, to get rid of soft power and to not see the addressing the disease as the primary issue would be, I think, very foolish in terms of the future.
And again, I'm speaking with Karen Greenberg, who's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law, a noted expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. She's the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, and Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And she has an article at Tom Dispatch, COVID-19 is Destroying the Myth of American Exceptionalism. So how much do you think, Karen, that Trump's America First idea, which I guess started to some extent with Stephen Bannon, has backfired, or has it really influenced the fact that Trump was in denial and was sort of guilty of magical thinking that this thing could go away? You know, I didn't need to relitigate all of the ridiculous things he said over the months that were wasted when we could have prevented this catastrophe. The South Koreans were able to do it. In Taiwan, they were able to do it. In New Zealand, they barely had any casualties. In fact, it seems that the countries that were the most successful in containing the pandemic were countries that have women as head of states.
and democracies that function as democracies. I think that's very interesting. Look, the real loss, I think, of the America First idea and Trump's idea is that America, ironically, is ending up last. What are we first in? We're first in deaths. We're also first in excusing ourselves, absenting ourselves from the global conversation. And that's not good for a lot of reasons. One is that if pandemic solution may very well be a joint effort from nations of all sorts, large and small, putting their heads together, both in terms of their scientists and their policy experts to talk about how to do this in the most effective way, how to solve the problem, how to address the pandemic in the most effective way, and to minimize the damage. And the other reality of it is that the more the United States pulls out, the more other forces, good and bad, can fill in to the international conversation. Do we really want to be out of it? And, you know, if it's not clear enough that that lives will be lost because of being out of it, what about out of the conversation? What about all the other things that are being lost in terms of decisions made about economics, about warfare, about diplomacy around the globe, dealing with conflicts and rising conflicts, both between nation states and non-state actors? And we want to be part of the conversation. And what we've done is to remove ourselves from the conversation under the banner of America First, and now to find ourselves out of the conversation, in part because we're the pariah nation. We're the nation with the disease that is out of control. And so it's the problems in this realm are just expanding in countless ways every single day.
Well, isn't there a danger, though, as the rhetoric against China heats up, and obviously Trump is using it as a campaign message to demonize China in order to deflect blame from himself? Is there a danger of reigniting a Cold War, or beginning a Cold War, I should say, with China?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were headed towards, you know, the great power rivalry tensions before this. This isn't just about COVID. There has been, you know, countless numbers of concerns registered within the national security community and elsewhere about intellectual property theft, about disinformation, about countless other things that we've been worried about with the Chinese, and they just seem to all get highlighted and brought under a microscope by the pandemic. So you can't blame that all on the pandemic. You have to blame that on the economic tensions that are going on in the world and the way in which technology has intersected with those tensions. The thing about COVID is it's just brought it home much more quickly to everybody. But it's not just the result of COVID.
But I understand a part of Trump's support in his base has, and perhaps it was a factor in getting him elected, if you can use that term, he really did in his campaign trash this idea of America as the global policeman and really went after Bush and the legacy of Iraq and Afghanistan and all of these losing wars. And he hasn't really had too many deaths on his watch, and he's sort of tried to get out, and he pulled out of Syria in a way that most people thought was reckless and counterproductive, but he wants to get out of Afghanistan, and I think that's kind of a campaign pledge that he made. But there's a lot of support for that. So do we have a problem here that these misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan have led to a kind of isolationism that is now completely the wrong attitude to have when you deal with COVID-19?
Right. Everything has to be seen in terms of, you know, quantity and quality. There have been many deaths on Trump's clock. There's been an escalation in drone warfare on Trump's watch. So I just want to mention that. It's not so easy to stop, quote unquote, policing the world. There are places where you probably want American intelligence on the ground, if not active military. But the idea that that we can just flip a switch and everything will be better is not going to work. And while it's true that he ran on that and that he has a lot of supporters across that, I think across both parties on reducing the American military footprint around the world, if you want to do that, then what you also have to do is de-escalate tensions. You can't come to the brink of war with North Korea, Iran, China, or anybody else, and then talk out of one side of your mouth about de-escalating conflict, which is a goal that, you know, I would embrace, and at the same time upping the tensions and upping the possibilities of war, even on a bigger scale than what we've seen.
Well, the worst thing that could happen if during this campaign the rhetoric against China heats up and there's some kind of naval incident in the South China Sea with those artificial islands that the Chinese have created. And frankly, back to the general thrust of what you've been telling us, Karen, is that in terms of soft power versus military might, it was, after all, the most powerful instrument the U.S. had to not so much contain China, but at least to make China play by the rules, was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They were organizing the entire neighborhood, and if China didn't play by the rules, it couldn't join the club and it couldn't trade. And then the first thing that Trump and Bannon did was get rid of it for no good reason except that it had Obama's name on it, just like the nuclear deal with Iran. It had Obama's name on it. And you can see that China's been flexing its muscles ever since. So we've squandered soft power with canceling the TPP, and we're recklessly threatening hard power with the idea of ginning up a Cold War with China.
There's no question. Pulling out of these treaties has been a precipitant to escalated tensions and potential conflict. I agree with you that keeping our eyes focused on what could happen in the South China Seas is incredibly important right now, and a place where the potential of some kind of violence, you know, eruption of conflict is could happen. And there's no question, look, this is all part of the isolationism, pulling out of these treaties, whether it's just to move away from Obama or it's because of a real desire to not have America belong in the war is not going to work. And just to your point about soft power, the evisceration of the State Department during the Trump administration is going to take some time and effort and resources to come back from. If there's a new president in the fall, the State Department has to be rebuilt if you want to have the voice of soft power there, if you want to have a diplomatic corps, if you're not going to leave a large percentage of your ambassadorships vacant for years, as happened in the beginning of this administration. And so there's a general, you know, sort of blanket been pushed over what was a vibrant State Department. And so just as a symbol of all these other efforts and issues, whether it's making treaties, whether it's knowing what's going on the ground, whether it's trying to have negotiations on everything from little details to big picture issues. How do you function without a State Department? And we've very much been put in that situation.
Well, Karen Greenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Karen Greenberg, who's director of the Center for National Security at Fordham University School of Law, a noted expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. She's the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, and Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And she has an article at Tom Dispatch, COVID-19 is Destroying the Myth of American Exceptionalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past. We'll be right back.
one more light goes on.